give staff the due that and the hard work that they have put into that. I would like to offer a perspective on this, and we fancy that we have choices, but I kind of go back to the law. And if you read the back of the budget, it says the maintenance of existing assets shall be the first priority of transportation funding for all modes, for highways, for transit, for ports, and airports. And in this budget, I think we can make a claim that we're doing the best we can for bridges. We're trying to recover on primary and secondary pavements, and we really don't know what we're doing on, we're doing the best we can on interstate and primary pavements, but we don't have a standard for secondary. And so if the law says the maintenance of existing assets is our first priority, that's the law, we're not meeting that standard. And one of the strictures on that, because then the very next thing is the maximization of federal revenues is also a first priority. And so the real choice in here is, do we maximize federal dollars, which some of you, some of those you can put on to replacing bridges and bad pavements, but a lot you can't. If you do that, we can't afford to fully maintain the system. That's the devil's dilemma that we are stuck with right now. And I think the recommendation here is trying to thread that needle, do something fair. And I'll just conclude by two things. One is, if we fail to act decisively here, with whether it's pavements or bridges, all it does is get more expensive. This is like a pension liability. If you don't nip it in the bud, it will grow and mushroom in cost. And secondly, based on what we know today, and the economy could turn around very dramatically, I don't think anyone around this table truly believes that. I think we would be back here in August or September doing more of this. And so, unfortunately, I think the stronger, and I would welcome recommendations, budget recommendations, even to go further if there's something reasonable and affordable. Because, again, in budgeting, the sooner you make the cut, the less painful that it is. If there are, Commissioner, did you want to have any closing remarks? And I can't say enough about the work that you have done, the leadership you've shown, and, you know, virtually every weekend for about 6 months has tied up the VDOT senior staff on this, and it's been a very impressive work effort. What I'd like to do, we have some very important consultants who are here to talk about some V-Trans stuff, so can we take a five-minute break, and let's call ahead and let them know. We're going to be definitely late for dinner. But there are some folks who have been waiting here to present some important V-Trans material.
You're awfully quiet today.
There have been some wise comments made around the table. I listened carefully to them. I don't have any more solutions.
This is B, that's congestion, that's mobility. So, yep. No problem.
I don't disagree with primary purpose, but how much of it is supposed to give them a...
Let's see if we can reconvene. The secretary is in the midst of a media interview, so we'll get started with the next item on the workshop. I'm just trying to exercise my authority as vice chair.
If you had money, we would.
I want to see if any of the board members listen to the vice chair.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm listening.
I'm listening.
Fraser Crane, I'm listening.
We're. I appreciate everybody getting back together again. We are going to pick up a critical piece that really builds on that forward-looking discussion as we move forward. And so I'll call on Deputy Secretary Davis to introduce the topic. Welcome, Ralph, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. What I want to do today is give you a brief update on V-Trans 2035, kind of a different setting than dealing with the current budget in terms of trying to look out to 2035. The most important piece of update is that we are having a series of public meetings. I think I sent out a note to email to you saying there are a series of public meetings that we're going to have, and they start next week. These meetings are in addition to meetings that we've already held. We had a meeting back in March, and that meeting was with stakeholders to get their input in terms of how do they view transportation in the long term. In April, we have had a meeting with regional planning planners and so forth. And starting next week, we're going to have basically four meetings around the state. And these meetings are with the general public. And that is going out to the public to say, what are your thoughts regarding transportation 2035? And we don't really have a good feel for what might occur in those meetings, given the level of cuts and so forth that we are incurring now. But it's a part of the planning process, and we're required to get public input, and that's what we're going to be doing over the next week. There are four meetings, one in Northern Virginia, one in Hampton Roads, Richmond, Roanoke. In addition to that, on a website, for those areas that we don't actually visit, there is a vehicle by which the public can provide, receive the same type of information, provide comments regarding their concerns, whether it's what they would like to see, whether it's with roads, whether it's with transit, rail, bike, and ped, and so forth. So we have vehicles. In addition to the public meetings, there is a website that we're developing that will have the same information for the public to respond to. Today, as you know, we've had a series of policy papers. We talked to you about environment. We talked to you about the fuels tax rate and so forth, and whether or not it's going to be a viable source of revenues in the future. Today, we have two papers, presentations. One is on congestion. The other paper is on mobility, accessibility, and connectivity. These papers have been reviewed by staff. I would say that they have not been fully vetted. The whole purpose of these papers are to present to you and to get your feedback in terms of what else might be needed, what are we missing in these issues. So the first paper is going to be on congestion. The format for doing the V-Trans 2035 is we're using consultants to do that. And we have we're going to have Mark Howard, who's with Cambridge Systematics. They've done a paper on congestion. I think you have an extra handout at your places where there's some additional strategies that we want to incorporate as well. And the other thing is for you to build on these if we're missing something. So Mark Howard will come forth first and talk about congestion. Following Mark Howard, we will have Dan Dalton from KFH, who will present on mobility, accessibility, and connectivity. Again, the whole idea is to get your feedback and input. The papers, as well as presentations, will be available on the V-Trans website. So if you can't provide feedback now, I'm always available to entertain your feedback. So you can provide information to me either via web, telephone, or whatever methodology. So the first presentation, if you have no questions of me, is going to be on congestion by Mark Harwood of Cambridge Systematics.
One quick question, Doctor. Is this the information you're basically going to share in your outreach sessions that are coming up?
In the outreach sessions, we will not be sharing this kind of information. It's mainly to get input. What we will do is go through these sessions. There are going to be a series of maps. There will be a map showing highway assets, a map showing transit assets, a map showing ports and airports, and we will be providing that information to the public, and the public will have access and have a chance to look at those maps and say how we'd like to improve, what's important to me. This type of information is not what we're providing to the public at this time.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Thanks for your attention. I appreciate that we're going into extra innings here, so I'll try to be brief. First of all, just what is the issue in terms of congestion? Congestion really is affecting all modes of transportation, whether it's highway, rail, rail transit, whether that's for people or for freight, and our air traffic as well. But specifically referring to traffic congestion, congestion is that the demand for a given facility is greater than the available capacity. That's the bottom line. And it should also be noted that congestion is a highly subjective issue. Tip O'Neill once said that all politics is local. Well, all congestion is local as well. Somebody in one part of the state may feel that their commute is one that's very difficult and time-consuming, but when you compare, say, one of the more smaller urban areas to Northern Virginia, there are some significant differences that are going to affect how you can address the problems. Causes are varied, but just in terms of traffic congestion, this pie chart gives you a sense of how the different elements add up. And non-recurring congestion, that is, things that aren't directly related to the physical configuration of the roadway, accounts for something like 55 or 60% of delay. And this is either because of special events, work zones, traffic incidents, which can include both collisions, crashes, or just debris in the roadway. These traffic incidents account for about a quarter of all congestion delay. Why is it important for urban congestion? The costs of congestion have really had an increasing impact in terms of lost wages, eroded productivity, the increased cost of goods movement, and people's quality of life as well. If somebody can't get home to pick up the kids at daycare, then they may be facing a fee and some ill will on the part of the daycare providers. Getting to and from work provides a additional stress and strain that really is making the quality of life a problem for a lot of travelers. The environmental impacts are substantial as well. Changes in technology have resulted in lower emissions per vehicle, but as vehicle miles traveled increases, then some of those gains have been eroded. Congestion is not just an urban problem. It can also have an impact on rural areas as well, whether it's seasonal impacts due to tourist traffic or extra congestion on the roads during a harvest season. Some rural traffic corridors also experience some significant congestion due to freight traffic, and one example of that is Interstate 81. But deficiencies, as I said before, exist for all modes, whether it's crowded metro rail trains, parking access for metro, and even in the area of freight, the Port of Virginia is facing considerable growth in freight traffic, but the access to and from the port areas can be problematic, whether it's for truck movements or for rail movements as well. Historically, the increases in road capacity, as you well know, have not kept pace with growth in vehicle miles traveled. Growth in VMT has somewhat abated. In 2007, there was less of an increase or even a stability in the amount of vehicle miles traveled. And we're likely to see a decline for 2008, although not for a reason that we applaud, because of problems with not only fuel prices, but economic activity slowing. But the significant delays that are faced in Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, and Richmond, the Northern Virginia travelers are experiencing about 60 hours a year in delays. That's in comparison to the national average of about 38 hours of delay. The Virginia Beach area is facing 30 hours of delay, and Richmond 20 hours of delay. The costs this is per traveler. The costs also include things like an extra 43 gallons of gas for travelers in Northern Virginia as a result of delay. Northern Virginia, for instance, is tied with San Francisco and Atlanta for average hours of delay per traveler, eighth overall in total delay costs. And commuting times are higher in Virginia than in a lot of other parts of the country. We're sixth in the nation, not as high as Maryland, for instance, which had about 30 hours or 30 minutes traveled en route to for the work trip, but higher than the national average of about 25 minutes. Congestion has contributed to increased costs for travelers, not just in terms of the hours spent in traffic, but Northern Virginia has seen about $1,094 per traveler per year, less but still significant in Virginia Beach and Richmond, but it really could have been worse. Operational improvements have saved a lot of time. In Northern Virginia, about 4 hours of annual delay saved per peak traveler. In Virginia Beach, about 3 hours of delay saved. And in Richmond, an hour delay saved as a result of adding HOV lanes, ramp meters, and so on. Public transportation also had a contributing effect. In Northern Virginia, there was about 12 hours of delay avoided through use of public transportation. In the Virginia Beach area, about an hour of delay avoided. These are the population growth forecasts from 2010 to 2035. This is the basis. Yes, sir.
Excuse me. I've never heard that measure before, but congestion avoided due to transit, is that a number that's tracked?
Yes, it's tracked, I believe, through the Urban Mobility Monitoring Program. Texas Transportation Institute and Cambridge Systematics have worked with them as well. But it gives you a sense of how bad things could have been if not for the presence of the public transportation services. Basically, the forecasts for daily vehicle mile traveled are based on population and employment statistics from two different sources, the Virginia Employment Commission and NPA data sources. They have somewhat different projections, but in the general range of 30 to 35%. And so they result in a number of, in some different forecasts of travel demand in terms of vehicle miles traveled. The moderate growth ranges are ones that we feel are probably the most likely, especially given the changes in the economy that we've seen recently. Just in terms of freight traffic, there's also a significant increase in volume at the Port of Virginia. Currently, the port generates about 4,000 trucks per day. At full build-out, the Craney Island project will generate about 5,000. The Maersk terminal will generate 2,000 trucks per day, and cargo may double even by 2015, and an increase of nearly 300% by 2040. 12 of the 227 freight bottlenecks in the United States occur in Virginia, and construction projects and work zones are going to continue to contribute to congestion, particularly in the Northern Virginia area, resulting in about 3 million hours of delay, or about $100 million per year. Some of the things that are actually having a positive impact, Virginia's extensive high occupancy vehicle system in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads saved travelers a significant amount of time. One HOV lane on I-95, for instance, provides free flow conditions for 10,750 people in 2,840 vehicles. Carpoolers in Northern Virginia saved 20,000 hours each morning peak period. In Hampton Roads, carpoolers saved almost 3,400 hours. And in the future, with the introduction of the high occupancy toll lanes through the public-private partnership, there's going to be a significant opportunity for people to pay their way out of congestion, if you will. Other systems, including advanced traveler information systems, the statewide 511 system, and contributes to needed traffic and transit information for travelers both before their trip starts and en route. And transit-oriented development has resulted in significantly higher density development in Metro Rail transit corridors. The Ballston station area, for instance, is looked at as a national leader in providing higher densities at transit stations and taking advantage of the office and residential spaces. So what's been done in other states? In the state of Washington, the Puget Sound area, they've introduced a number of operations measures and ITS systems, including incident management, ramp metering, signal synchronization and retiming, information on travel conditions and commute time information, and also reducing or removing capacity bottlenecks that have resulted in significant reductions in congestion. One of the things that they're also trying is value pricing. What you see on the screen here is one of the State Route 167 hot lanes, and you can see that they're using dynamic pricing so that you actually pay more during the periods of highest congestion so that you maintain a free flow on the hot lanes. That's something we'll be seeing here in Virginia before too long. They also have a what they call do something and measure it. When they implement a program, they're very careful to come up with very understandable and accessible performance measures so that people can see what the impact is of projects and can understand that they're getting something for the expenditure on new projects. Ramp metering in particular has had a significant impact, and they found that short entrance ramp wait times are made up for by shorter freeway travel times, considerably lower rates of crashes, about 30% fewer crashes, and lower travel delay. In California, in the Los Angeles area, they're converting 85 miles of HOV lanes to hot lanes. They're also going to be purchasing high-capacity compressed natural gas transit buses that will operate in the hot lanes. And this takes the revenue that's being generated by the hot lanes and plowing it back into the transit system to serve people who are maybe not able to afford or unwilling to pay for hot lanes. They're also undertaking a sustainable community strategy where communities are encouraged to coordinate land use and transportation, areas that have actually come up with a plan for reducing VMT are able to get grants from the state for implementing these programs of coordinating land use and transportation. That's Senate Bill 3756. With approved plans, communities are eligible for state and federal grants to create a sustainable regional transportation system. In Texas, they're looking at what they call metropolitan mobility plans, and in eight of the highest population centers in the state of Texas, They're developing these plans which forecast what they'll be able to accomplish for the expenditure of a given amount of funding. And then over time, they'll implement these programs with specific projects. But even at the very beginning of the process, they're able to talk to the people in their communities and get them to understand what the funding is going to affect and how the implementation of these plans will result in reduced congestion and improved service. In New Jersey, they're looking at a program called NJFIT, New Jersey's Future in Transportation. And they actually looked with some dismay at some of the figures on the national obesity numbers and considering what the impact is of their program on actually the cost of their program in certain areas. So they came up with a comprehensive and cooperative approach to coordinating transportation and land use planning, downsizing alternatives so that they're less expensive to build, increasing the transportation options, lowering design speeds in some communities using traffic calming measures and other strategies to make the a more sensible fit of their transportation facilities to the neighborhood characteristics, and looking for pedestrian-friendly streetscapes that encourage more activity on the streets, walking and bicycling, rather than just designing for vehicles. So this toolbox of strategies that they're encouraging the localities use for traffic calming, transit-oriented design, environmental sensitivity, and a mix of land uses, they're working in partnership with local governments and civic organizations to come up with a right size of transportation facilities for the communities. So looking at what Virginia is going to be able to do in the future and some basic philosophy, if you will, of how to approach congestion management. First of all, strategies that will reduce the need for travel or shift the time of day. Second, encouraging the use of alternative modes, whether it's getting people into transit or encouraging them to use bicycles or walking to work. Shifting trips into higher occupancy vehicle, whether it's a carpool or a van pool. Improving the operations of your traffic transportation facilities to carry vehicles more efficiently. And then only as a last resort, increasing capacity where it's appropriate. So what are some of the things that the state of Virginia can do based on its current track record and some of the examples from elsewhere in the country? Addressing the jobs-housing balance, encouraging people to live where they work by expanding affordable housing options and encouraging people to think about living closer to their jobs. Encouraging transit-oriented development, compact mixed-use development near new or existing public transportation facilities, and pedestrian-oriented design. Implementing travel demand management programs, moving more people in fewer vehicles, moving trips out of the peak periods. Telework, for instance, can save the taxpayer about $2,800 a year in road improvements and expansion. Expanding travel options and modes, providing alternatives to the automobile, such as bicycle and pedestrian facilities and public transportation, and encouraging initiatives such as car sharing and bike sharing. Your flex cars and your bicycle sharing programs at transit stations. In addition, expanding high-occupancy vehicle and high-occupancy toll lanes. Virginia currently has 137.6 miles of HOV lanes, over 10% of the lane miles in the United States. And HOT lanes can capture people's willingness to pay for additional mobility while ensuring free-flowing traffic. Expanding smart highways programs using technology, initiatives such as ramp metering, safety service patrols, transportation system management and operations, supporting the IntelliDrive program, formerly known as VII, to support safety and mobility, investigating the potential of active traffic management, which uses things like variable speed limits, lane guidance, monitoring and surveillance, to make the best use of existing facilities, and freight initiatives such as electronic screening and safety information exchange, and technologies such as Way in Motion. And finally, continuing to pursue public-private partnerships in order to get the best facilities at the least cost to the public and that's already been a very successful program in Virginia and deserves to be continued. Finally, you have in front of you, or should have at your place, this isn't part of the presentation, but Cambridge Systematics put together a National Cooperative Highway Research Program report on the effectiveness of various congestion mitigation strategies. This hasn't been worked into our paper so far, but as you can see, there are we have a matrix which compares the effectiveness of different strategies and what area, what the most appropriate area of application is, whether it's a local or an area-wide strategy, and then some of the issues in terms of implementing the strategies, whether they're low, medium, or high cost, non-cost barriers, which is institutional issues and technological issues, and finally, what's the time frame in which they might be implemented. So some of these conclusions will be worked into the paper as well. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
One question, Mr. Chairman. On the 12 of the 227 freight bottlenecks, are those all on road or some on rail, or what is the combination there?
Those are specifically for the freight bottlenecks in the state of Virginia, but they're they affect passenger traffic as well. But this is from a national survey of where freight is having particular problems.
But do you know if they're on the rail or on the highway system?
I think it's this is primarily on the highway system, I believe.
That would be helpful to get that list of 12 bottlenecks.
Chair, I think that's part of our freight study.
Yes.
Come out of that freight study, we can make that available.
If you could send that around, I think that'd be a very interesting piece of information.
Send that
Thank
to the
you.
Rail Advisory Board too.
And the rail and the road bottlenecks tend to parallel each other.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing how that happens. Any, Mr. Schwartz.
Yeah, I don't understand. This looks inconsistent. Under hierarchy of strategies in your report, the last one on the list is increased capacity, and you said and that's sort of a last resort thing. And then I look at this matrix and new roads and roadway widening sort of tops the list. It's rated high in effectiveness both locally and area-wide. The two seem inconsistent.
Well, the issue is you're looking just on the benefit side. The cost side is that it's extremely expensive to provide those that new capacity, and there are also environmental hurdles that have to be faced. Local resistance, whether it's a NIMBY syndrome, if you're living there, or local opposition, if you're, you know, it's not just a matter of what the effectiveness of the solution is if it's designed right and implemented appropriately, but also what some of the impediments are to achieving it. And
so effectiveness doesn't include cost-benefit analysis.
That's correct. You have to look at, you know, both sides of the effectiveness side and the implementation issue side.
Okay. Let me just make a suggestion. To me at least, that's a little misleading, because when I think of the effectiveness of a solution, I think of both the cost and the benefit. And I think a lot of what you said on here is right on point. I'm just not sure that this table matches in terms
well,
of
that was,
the...
It was two different efforts, and they haven't been really reconciled yet.
Okay,
fair enough. This is coming off of a different effort that was done nationwide for a different audience.
But
we'll make sure that as this information is incorporated into the white paper, that we reflect that issue of what the philosophical approach might be of going in this hierarchy of approaching transportation congestion problems, and then the difference between the cost and benefit.
Okay.
Mr. Eckern.
As a comment, I guess, I for years have struggled as the transportation professional community has tried to relate congestion to a rural setting.
My conclusion is that given the strategies that we've developed, we need to recognize that the rural issues we face clearly are not congestion related. I sense that more, let me see, I got to say this nicely, as an accommodation to try to understand that as we target funding, as we target solutions, we're trying to say it is a broad tent, but clearly several of the board members have made an impression on me that the issue in rural Virginia, as it is in the other parts of the country where I've worked, does not come under a congestion tent. And in reality, my customer struggles with that because they know when you apply the cost benefit, it's really hard to telework in your commodities from the farm to the community. So in the context of our 2035 direction, I really encourage us to segregate our rural strategy, what we need to do to maintain the quality of life, the other parts of what makes Virginia great, from the strategies that we need to deal with for congestion in our heavily congested urban areas. It's never been more real to me as a professional than since I've been in the Commonwealth.
Mr. Chairman,
I was trying to follow that. Are you suggesting then that we have a dual system?
Mr. Chairman, what I'm suggesting is that you need to understand the dynamic of the problem that we're facing, both from an urban and a rural perspective. These solutions work, but they work in heavily urban areas. They work in our congested areas. When I talk about the strategies that we need for 2035 in Greater Virginia, I'm not viewing these as exactly parallel. I think we need to tailor our solutions.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask if we have any evidence to support number three, that it's saving us money. Now, I realize that the public-private partnerships are a way to access capital. But I'm not convinced, and never have been, that they save the Commonwealth any money. And there's a simple logic behind that, that cost of money and not having to pay a profit set against efficiency supposedly gained in the private sector don't offset. And I've never understood the logic of how a PPTA is saving the Commonwealth money. Instead, perhaps the only reason I can justify it when I vote in here when we have these things is that it's access to capital they don't have available any other way. But it's actually going to cost us a lot more money. And I think the public needs to be told that. I don't have my evidence to show it. I just know logically that it can't be otherwise.
Well, let me respond to that, and I'm sure others will want to chime in, but I'll just list off three facilities that would not be without public-private partnership.
You heard what
before.
I said about access to capital.
Yeah. Well, but it's not just access to capital, it's contribution. The private sector is paying 70% of the cost of the Route 28 improvements. In the case of the Capital Beltway, the private financing there is about 75% of that. In the case of Dulles Rail, the percentage is smaller, more probably in the range of 15 or 20%, but very critical. It's the landowners. Those projects would not happen without both that as a way of blending public and private resources and without access to both public and private capital. You need them both. The question, do you save money? The cost of capital is clearly higher. I believe in the case of Capital Beltway, the average cost of capital is about 8.5%. If we had access to, say, a debt mechanism, we might have been able to do it revenue bond, say, 5.5%. That's a significant differential, but we don't have that. And so the choice in those instances, there's very clear...
I voted in favor.
Yeah, I think in the case of those large projects, they would not be without that blending of public and private resources. there are, in the early days of the program, so for example, Route 288 was essentially a design build and 100% publicly financed, probably worth going back and looking at. The assumption was, well, let's do a pavement warranty. And so you'd have to do a life cycle cost analysis. We're going to have to look at the TAMS contracts, the outsourcing at some point. Those are all very legitimate questions. But I think on the capital side, one of the things that's interesting to me, if you add up depreciation plus, for example, the what's the name of the bond program, Rita? The TIFIA bonds, as well as the other private activity bonds, all of which are tax-exempt. A private entity that can access tax-exempt capital and take depreciation, which is the situation we have now, actually may have an overall cost that's less than the public sector. So really, it does depend, and I think as we have gotten better and bigger with the PPTA program, I think those are the superior. If you look at the big projects in Virginia and Southwest Virginia, Coalfields Expressway, we went through a very difficult transition period. That road's being built now against all odds, and it's cost savings. It's not, instead of having to restore the ground to original contour, they restore it to a roadbed, and it is a win-win situation.
Mr. Chairman, the only other consideration in that same formula, recognizing the benefits of what you're talking about, is that in the private sector, companies come and go a lot faster than government comes and goes. And I wonder, 20 years from now, what the financial structure will be of some of those companies that made those commitments and how we, then the government, is going to pick up when they fail. And that has to be another consideration as well to look at with them. So the balance is there, and I understand the environment we're in, and I've supported them thus far, but I'm simply not convinced that it's a huge part of the long-term solution for the future of our roads.
And the most optimistic scenario is about 20% of highway needs through a public-private partnership. You can't pave Main Street. You can't maintain existing infrastructure in that way. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two comments. First, I take the point that the commissioner made about congestion being a different issue in rural areas and urban areas, but I want to mention that I still think that many of the things that you talked about here have a relevance to rural areas, particularly the stuff relating to land use strategies, alternate commuting strategies, so forth, because it seems to me that when we're talking about long term, which is what V-Trans 2035 is, part of the objective here is to try to assist rural areas that have a need, have a desire to grow, to do it in more functional and efficient ways so that in 2035 they're not facing the huge and costly challenges that our urban areas are facing. So there's a component of this kind of planning that I think is absolutely relevant to rural areas so that when and as they grow, they don't end up chasing their sons and daughters away because they can't afford to stay there in any efficient, sustainable way. So I think that point needs to be made. And I just also want to say, Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're saying about public-private partnerships. I share Dr. Davis's skepticism about public-private partnerships. I don't disagree that they may well have a place in an overall system, and they may have uses, but I also do think that there are clear costs that as part of a long-term planning strategy exercise, there ought to be transparency about what it does really cost to go that route in the absence of other sources of capital. And also, I think in terms of a long-term planning exercise, there are different kinds of public-private partnerships. You talked about a couple examples. Route 28 was one. I think there was another where it's not so much a structure where you're just accessing the private sector for either capital or perhaps for construction, but you're tapping into value that a particular project creates for the private sector and looking for mechanisms where the private sector can actually compensate, actually pay for some of that value that's being created for it. That's a kind of a different public-private strategy, but that, it strikes me, is one that has a whole lot of potential as
well.
I'm
glad you brought that up, because really where we have tried to focus our program in recent years, you know, some states are about extracting value, so taking an existing toll road, securitizing it, taking the value out is one approach. Would not be, I don't think, would be appropriate in Virginia, but all of the ones that we just discussed briefly are value capture mechanisms, if you think about them. That's an excellent observation.
I mean, when, take, for example, Dulles Rail or any, as a former real estate developer, I mean, it's pretty easy to understand that when you do something like that, you double, triple, quadruple the value of a lot of the property in that area. And so some sort of public-private partnership that captures some of that value creation and brings it back, I think, is something that's pretty interesting to look at as part of our long-term planning. But the point that Dr. Davis makes about the cost of capital in the more narrowly structured public-private partnerships, you know, whether it tolls, all that sort of thing, those are public assets. And I do take the point that you're not stretching those dollars, the value of those public assets, nearly as much when you're using private capital for those projects. So.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Kulimek?
Yeah, I'm very interested in the strategies. I think these have all occurred to us at one point or another. For example, the recessionist moment is really serving that purpose of reducing need for travel. The unemployment rate and the congestion rates sort of are
pretty much in lockstep. Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of empty capacity in Detroit right now. The others, though, I wonder, these are all listed like they occur equally, and they're equally easy to accomplish. But, in fact, your chart shows there's a lot of these that are really low to medium in effectiveness or low. And I think one thing we have to be aware of, the timelines on these things are very, very different. Trying to change, say, the policy, public policy related to jobs and housing balance, very difficult. What you would say is, you know, transit-oriented development demands more density and multifamily units and so forth, but all of our incentives really are for single-family homes. Try to change that.
And there's also the issue of something that is going to come up in a later paper, which is the disconnect between regional and local decision-making and what can be done at another level of government.
Right, and I noticed that, and I wrote down, like, give all localities more tools, get the state out of some of this business. You know, right, Dillon Rural State just frowns on that stuff. I'm not sure why. There's not some kind of modified Dillon Rural State. Seems like the legislature would be tired of this side.
Ms. Kume, can I intervene here? We've got two more work session items which we have to finish tonight. And we also have to be at dinner by 7 o'clock. So we need to rush through. If we could maybe move on to the next presentation very quickly.
Can I just ask one other question?
Sir.
We've discussed in general some of the recommendations of the Governor's Climate Commission here. In other words, looking at transportation from an environmental perspective as well as from a capacity area. And I'm not sure, at some point those ought to be folded in here because some of them make more sense.
I believe that's going to be a topic of another one of the white papers.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there's a separate paper on low environment climate change that, in fact, you heard it. Some of you heard it last week on the environment, but the climate change, I mean, last session, where the climate change initiatives of the governor were included in our set of recommendations.
Okay. All right. Next up, mobility, accessibility, and connectivity. And I apologize for the long day for all of you.
No problem at all. We're glad to be here. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss the issues paper that we put together, but I really feel the pressure now to make sure I get done so you get to dinner on time. Just want to start off again with the format for our issues paper, very similar to what Mr. Howard just presented, because we used basically the same format. Defining the issue, we took information right out of the performance report, right out of the 2035 vision report. One thing that we highlight in the issues paper is the fact, though, that because this issue is interrelated with many other issues that are in other issues papers, congestion, roadway capacity, freight, land use. There's a lot of other issues papers that this is connected with. So what we did was we focused a lot on intermodal connectivity and also on the on populations, people with disabilities, older adults, people with low incomes, people who actually need other transportation options, that either choose to have need, to have an option or need another transportation option. So that's mentioned in the issues paper. Again, define the issue. We talk about the fact of building upon that, that the vision report emphasized opportunities to improve mobility for those populations that, again, who may have less travel options than other populations. And also mentioned the Code of Virginia actually sets out some specific goal for addressing the transportation needs of people with disabilities, or excuse me, people with limited mobility. Again, included in the paper, we in the definition of the issue, just talking about the different agencies, all the support for transportation throughout the state in Virginia, but then highlight the particular concerns of transportation needs for people with disabilities, older adults, and people with low incomes. And again, the fact that from an economic standpoint, from a social standpoint, these populations will need a variety of mobility options now and especially in the future as we look ahead to 2035 to remain a major part of the community, to access jobs, and to get the shopping, medical appointments, and those things. This is a short list of why this issue is important that we highlight. Obviously, there's a variety of different issues or different areas of why this issue is important. Meeting the growing need for mobility options, I don't think that anybody here is surprised by the fact that the senior population in the state is growing, I believe, to double by the 2035 to be, I think, 19% of the population. Obviously, just the population growing overall is obviously going to have an impact on mobility, accessibility, and connectivity. And obviously today, as you've talked a lot about the financial issues related to supporting transportation, there is even much more of a dramatic need now and will be in the future to make sure that the existing services are being used efficiently, effectively, and that also they connect then too. And regional accessibility from the standpoint of not just allowing people to get to access maybe services in another region, but actually within their region, actually allow people to get the locations right within their community and supporting mechanisms and supporting policies actually that will allow people to get to where they need to go right within their area, get jobs closer to their homes, services closer to their homes. I won't go through this whole list for the sake of time, but we highlight a lot of the solid foundation of efforts and activities that obviously you're quite aware of in Virginia, from services that are available to the fact that performance measures have been identified and are part of the performance summary report. The fact that there's a process for getting input from the disability community and from older adults through other plans that are in place. And there's actually been a review through DRPT of the funding for human service type transportation, specialized transportation provided typically by like a human service agency for the people they serve to allow them to get to doctor's appointments and get to social visits. There's actually been a review of that which actually identified the amount of money that's being spent in Virginia on those services. A lot of work is already in place. This again is highlighted in the issues paper. Again, probably not a surprise to the group, the fact that the transit in the state has grown dramatically, much higher than actually throughout the rest of the country, and also the fact that the DRPT has reported that the number of vehicle miles to travel saved by customers of commuter assistance agencies has actually increased by 25% over the last 3 years. So again, a dramatic increase in the use of transit and also other options then too to allow people to get where they need to go. One thing that DRPT also has led from the standpoint of statewide leadership is the fact of establishing a interagency coordinated transportation council that actually includes the other state agencies that fund the human service transportation that I mentioned too. So this is really key to actually have a state level committee to talk about these issues. In addition, one of the many things that Virginia's done too is complete a United We Ride report that actually then again detailed the human service type transportation in the communities throughout the state, particularly looking at the unmet transportation needs. Particularly what was heard was the fact that people need additional transportation options in the evenings, on weekends, a more frequent service, a need for same day services too. Again, a lot of the transportation options and services that many people take for granted because they can just jump in their car each day and go where they need to go, this actually looked a lot at the people who, again, who meet other transportation options other than just their automobile. Of course, we highlight VDOT and DRPT and their leadership that they've actually provided. That's included in the issues paper, too, especially from the fact of encouraging connectivity at the local level and providing technical and financial assistance to local transportation providers. Some other parts of the, again, that makes Virginia unique is a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Transportation and the Department of Health and Human Services. In addition to that, then, there has been state support for the New Freedom Program. This is a program that funds transportation services for people with disabilities beyond the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the state actually put up 45% of the needed match for that. There's a federal requirement for the local match, and actually the state showed leadership by actually putting that money up, too. Rural transportation planning from the standpoint of long-range transportation planning in the rural areas, and also include ensuring the fact that some coordinated planning processes that are already in place are a part of that. And the one thing that Virginia, again, has an opportunity for is excellent coordination models that are in place to coordinate all this different public transit and human service transportation. Jaunt in the Charlottesville area, Radar in the Roanoke area are a couple of the examples that the state has that are really not just shining examples in Virginia, but actually are examples that are used throughout the country. Again, tying that to the fact that the relevant lessons from around the country, the effort that DRPT and the Interagency Coordinated Transportation Council, very, very consistent with what's going on at the federal level of trying to better coordinate all the public transit and human service transportation. There are 64 different federal programs that fund public transit and human service transportation, so obviously there's a need for this then, too, and Virginia, again, is setting an example by that. Mobility management, kind of a buzzword at the federal level, too, of actually having the focus not on the mode of transportation, actually on the customer, getting the customer where they need to go. And so there's right now a strong emphasis on mobility management, and we'll talk a little bit about that more in just a minute. So, again, that's a lot of background to get us to some of the initiatives and opportunities that we've identified in the issues paper. They fit these five main categories, and again, in the sake of time, I'll go through the next one, the first one. Filling gaps in service to expand mobility options. Couple of the considerations, again, pretty much things that you would think would be available and no-brainers is the fact of expanding the reach of public transit services and also increasing the frequency of public transit services. Obviously, there's many areas of the state where there is transportation, public transportation services of some type will be needed between now and 2035. Also is to expand specialized or more paratransit services. A lot of people will need this service now, will need this in the future. There's an ADA requirement for paratransit services. That is a floor, not a ceiling, so there's a lot of room for opportunity where people will need services way beyond what the ADA requires. And also expanding volunteer driver programs. Some of the programs here in the state, it's popping up a lot around the country where you have more specialized one-on-one type of volunteer driver programs to allow people where they need to go, but also provide that assistance that a lot of people, especially seniors, will need to actually to travel to doctor's appointments and other locations. I mentioned mobility management. Again, this is a prime opportunity. The state is funding actually 10 mobility managers around the state right now, and there's the opportunity to expand upon that. This is a way to have someone who is looking to make sure the service is connected, to ensure that maybe there's just one number that people have to call to access services. This is an effort that, again, is a prime opportunity for future from the standpoint of making sure that services are being provided as efficiently and as effectively as possible. The single point of entry. We hear a lot from people about the fact they have to call three different numbers to access transportation services. One may be by a public transit provider, one by a human service agency, maybe you actually have to call someone else then for another type of service. Just having one number that people can call, and this can be a poor part of a mobility management structure, and obviously just makes more efficient sense for them and actually also for the transportation provider. Ensuring safe mobility for older drivers. We talked a lot about services to beyond actually people using their automobile, but obviously there can be education, there can be improvements to highway signs, those type of things to allow people to continue to drive and continue to remain independent. Obviously that's going to be the primary source of transportation, primary travel mode that most people are going to want to use, but to actually ensure those people can do that safely for them and for everyone in the community is very, very important and actually obviously can be a focus. Travel training programs. A lot of times there are transit systems or there are transportation programs that people are just unsure about using the first time, and so there are some great travel training programs in Virginia that can be expanded or implemented in areas where there aren't those kind of programs to allow people to use the transportation options that are available. And then last on this slide, we have expanding or implementing taxi voucher programs. We find a lot of communities that do have taxi services that this is a great way for people to get where they need to go. It gives them the independence of where they actually can have a trip for that same day. And also, I guess it fits in with the public-private partnerships because obviously then it's expanding services that are already being provided by a private transportation provider in an area. Well, on this slide, too, a lot of these are interrelated by the fact that land use issues, transit-oriented development, Mr. Howard already touched on some of these, so I won't go into detail, but we've also included environmental barriers, ensuring, again, that there's sidewalks and there's access to allow people to use the services that are available. And also then, too, one proposed something that's been suggested to us is obviously then tying state transportation funding to local land use policies. This, again, ensuring that somehow, in some way, transportation and land use are connected. I assume that this actually, again, is an issue that would be much more detailed in the land use issues paper also. But again, we want to make sure that we include it in here because of the, excuse me, the connection it has with mobility and connectivity and accessibility. Lastly, a couple other things for consideration, promoting aging in place, much more of a national focus on allowing people to live in their home and to stay in their home. Obviously, there is that will be great, good for them, good for their families, good for society, but obviously there is a mobility aspect that's important that will allow people actually to have get to the services they need if they're promoting, if aging in place takes part. Coordinated human service mobility. Again, DRPT led the development of 21 coordinated human service mobility plans around the state. This actually was had the involvement of a number of different agencies and organizations and extensive outreach with the public. Those plans were already in place, so there is that serves as a great foundation for future planning activities and to making sure, again, that service, excuse me, that the focus on planning is not just in the urban areas or rural areas, it's throughout the state, and it actually has, again, the broader impact of looking at all different types of services and all different types of transportation providers. Managed lanes, obviously, happening in some parts of the state, that's something we've also included. And then last, we also know the fact that the opportunity for supporting car sharing then, too. So. As you can tell, I can talk very fast if need be, so I would be glad to answer any, but I would, especially any, with that dinner pressure on me, too,
right,
I probably talked even faster, but is there any...
Tough act to proceed. Are there any other questions or comments? I think it's fair to say the gist of this is, you know, don't forget the less privileged and the folks who sometimes get left out of more traditional transportation. That's the essence of what's being presented here. Mr. Schwartz?
Just a real quick, the big takeaway from this, and I thought it was very good, by the way, for me, was that huge percentage in increase of the population that will be elderly in 2035, because if we don't do things to make sure that that huge percentage of the elderly can use mass transit and so forth and so on, we could lose all the gains that we've made. This is a function of the aging population. That's a big takeaway from this for me.
Right. It's a different system.
By 2035,
I'll
one
be there before 2035.
They say by 2035, one in five people in Virginia will be over 65.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
really
just a stunning number when you think about that.
One in
five.
We still have a lot of companies.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have one more item to do if there are no more questions. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And a really great framework to orient. Mal Curley has one last, and if anyone can do it in 5 minutes, it is the preeminent chief engineer.
Take me 5 minutes to get to figure out how to get it up here. Let's see.
Well, while you're doing that, why don't I read something that Rita Busher sent to me. This is a very short news flash, but it's very appropriate. It is a news release from the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, and it says that this morning I went from Mr. LaHood, this morning I went to Capitol Hill to brief members of Congress on the situation with the Highway Trust Fund. I'm proposing an immediate 18-month highway reauthorization that will replenish the highway trust fund. If this step is not taken, the trust fund will run out of money as soon as August, and states will be in danger of losing vital transportation funding they need and expect. As part of this, I'm proposing that we enact critical reforms to help us make better investment decisions with cost-benefit analysis, focus on more investments in metropolitan areas, and promote the concept of livability to more closely link work and home, something we've been talking about a couple times today. The administration opposes a gas tax increase during this challenging recessionary period, which has hit consumers and businesses hard across the country. I recognize we'll be concerned, however, with the reality of our fiscal environment and the critical demand. We should not rush legislation. We should work together on a full reauthorization that meets the demands of this country. The first step is making sure that the Highway Trust Fund is solvent, which is true. This is very, very important. So those of you who are involved in federal issues, we need to encourage this. Mr. Chief Engineer, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to talk very briefly about agenda item 10 for tomorrow. And basically what I'm going to ask you, that agenda item resolution that you have, basically authorizes the commissioner the same authorization that you gave him on 495. Has to do with limited access control. The policy on limited access, this basically says Commonwealth Transportation Board controls limited access. That includes shifting, moving, or braking, or any combination of these. So as we develop the 95-395 project, we are looking at the interchanges, and there are some unknowns that the private sector has from the viewpoint when we need to go to, as we move toward going to financial closure, going to sign a comprehensive agreement, which we're not at that stage yet, and that will come back to you for the major business points before we get there. This is just in the project development. There are unknowns, and we want to try to take that unknown out of the equation. Here gives you an example here at Lorton. And everything I'm going to show you has been shown at public hearings. It will go through our normal project development process. What we would like you to do, though, is grant the commissioner the authority to say that these limited access proposal changes that we're going to do on 95-395 are acceptable so we can develop the plans. This shows you at Lorton that we would have a, this is a pedestrian bridge coming over. So that would break the limited access line. That'd be a requirement that we have to come to the board. Here is at Seminary Road where the hot lanes would come in and tie into Seminary Road. That would be another access from 95 to Seminary Road. That would have to come to the board. And here's an example down at Shirlington with another access point that we would tie in. So what this would require is any time that we're tying in, creating a new access to 95, when we're at interchanges where we might put a ramp out where we have to move the limited access line back 5 feet or so, the policy requires that the board approves it. Agenda item number 10 is a resolution that would, you would approve the limited access changes for Interstate 95-395 as determined by VDOT to be necessary for the construction, maintenance, and operation of Interstate 95-395, set forth these conditions. The Commonwealth Transportation Commissioner would be authorized to execute any documents on that. And that's what this proposal is. Yes, sir.
That slide you have there, is that the one that was in the paper the other day about coming right up to the edge of homes that are...
I didn't see the paper. I don't know if it was in the paper or not.
There was a big
sir.
Article in the Washington Post about it over the weekend, yep. I think.
On the downside, there is no... That's a park over there, I believe. Mr. Secretary, you probably know it better than I do. There's no homes
there,
on that side.
There's a park, Fairfax, which is... on one side, there is residential on the south side that borders immediately upon that.
Yeah, that yellow line on the bottom, I don't know how else to describe it. All the yellow lines, is all that new?
Those are all in here. I believe the yellow is existing, and we're widening. I think there's two lanes there. We're widening to three lanes. But there is a configuration right now that we're changing a little bit and expanding the capacity.
I think what's fair to say here is this is all within the existing right-of-way footprint. There is no right-of-way acquisition.
Yeah, basically it's where it says new up here. We're creating a new access from 95, so that's a break in the limited access of how you can get on 95, off 95 is why you'd have this. This is similar to what the board approved as we were trying to develop 495, just to take that uncertainty away from the private sector partner.
But again, it's an access issue. You're not adjusting the right of way.
No,
doing,
no. And everything will be have been shown at public hearings and will go through our normal process from the engineering, environmental, and public hearing.
The difference between the yellow and the orange on the.
You know, quite frankly,
if I may, just haven't grown up here. The orange are new actual physical improvements. The yellow is all existing there.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to reemphasize the point that this is a basic step in project development. It's not actually endorsing the changes that you might actually see there. It's simply illustrating those. Some of this is more controversial than the Hot Lanes Beltway project. Mm-hmm. It does run in a much narrower footprint. You do have existing development and, you know, tighter and closer to the interchanges. We do have the BRAC problem at Seminary Road, where a bunch of new people are going to come there, whether there's any improvements or not. But I would just say that specifically there have been some serious discussions about that last Sherlington slide from Arlington, from residents,
right,
from the government itself, that we're trying to work through.
That's correct.
And I just wanted to make clear that VDOT is still in active discussions. They're developing, you know, what's going to be acceptable to both the private partner and to the county and to other parties. So all that's going to continue. I do have a broader question, however, and I realize it's a touchy one. How would you characterize really the probability of this project going forward in the near term? I know that the markets have changed. It's not the same as the Hot Lanes project from the Beltway. Some people want to wait and see how that one works out. I mean, what is, without revealing your hand in negotiations, I mean.
Well, I think the goal is to come what's known as commercial close by August, which we think is doable. But then financial close will have some market dependency. That can't happen overnight, and there would be some period of time between commercial close and financial close to bring the deal to construction. And that's one. There are two things going on with these large projects, and we learned a lot from the Beltway. You know, the design build process actually allows you to make changes as the project is being built. And so we had a very good experience in Fairfax County coming back and solving the sound wall and some of the neighborhood issues. This is more, in some respects, more complicated because it's a longer corridor and it traverses a much greater variety of land uses. But most of the development is in the middle of the road as opposed to on the outside. And so I think we get to commercial close in August, and there'll be some period of time during which the chief financial officer and the chief engineer have to say, execute. If it, and there would be some finite clock. If it doesn't happen, then all of that work will be for naught. I think that's a fair characterization. Mal? Rita?
That's a fair characterization. Yes, sir.
Well, for my part, Mr. Chairman, I'm comfortable proceeding, knowing that a lot of the decisions are still ahead. One criticism that we've all had of this process, of this type of process, is that there's broad delegation of power to contract and then very little power to review what the contractual arrangements actually are. Now, that's an important part of the process. I'm not trying to say we should try to have it both ways. But I think in this case, because there are so many, so many who are anxious to contribute to the final look of the project, that we want to make sure that when we do these approvals of broad authority, that we're not overlooking those. And I personally am comfortable that we're not, and I want to say that for the record. So.
Yeah. And one of the things that people overlook under a traditional project, folks never saw this. In some respects, these large P3 projects are subject to more incremental scrutiny. I mean, look at the Capitol Beltway or 28, where that design evolved even as things were under construction. Now it drives the chief engineer nuts because there are changes as construction is underway. But it is a more interactive process, which has both strengths and weaknesses.
I just want to ask one final question. Mal, is there you didn't hint at any access changes at or near the Pentagon. I know that that's a major part of the project, too.
I had another slide in there, sir. I took it out trying to get the numbers down because I figured the more slides I showed, the more questions you might ask.
That's probably true.
And I would say, just for the benefit of Ms. Coulomb, Ms. Connolly, I think the challenging issues from a transportation, and there's a whole set of commercial and financing issues, but on this project is so powerful. In fact, I'd like to share with the presentation I did to Senator Barker's committee this morning. But if you think about it, to have managed lanes, because 95 will not get wider, to take, as they're doing in a number of, you saw earlier, a number of states around the country converting HOV to HOT, the challenge is actually is inside the beltway where you have the more constrained right-of-way, the more mature land uses. And at Seminary Road, at the Pentagon, and actually at EPG, a little bit in Shirlington. But those the three inside the beltway, Shirlington, Pentagon, and Seminary Road, are very, very difficult situations. And just for example, at Shirlington, Alexander, which has half of that, is all residential on one side, and Arlington is on the other with very robust commercial and mixed-use development. So it's tough making those things all work.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I have absolutely no personal objection to the proposal to give that authority to the commissioner, but is there any legal question as to the legal authority of this board to delegate a responsibility that's imposed by statute?
Madam Counsel? It is a CTB policy, so it's not set in statute. The policy about limited access control is established by the CTB, and the CTB is in this instance choosing to delegate. I think that's correct. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Because we have almost made our time limit. We're 6 minutes late. And the address of the restaurant is? 2601 Cary Street. So we'll see y'all right there. We're meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow. Is that correct? We expect a large number of folks to come out to share their wisdom prior to the business meeting. So come prepared.
I can give it to you tomorrow. Do you mind?
Yeah, I got to jump in a car.
Oh, wait.